Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. My Jacksonville co-host, Melissa Ross, is out this week. So the government health care plan for people over 65, Medicare, it really has become a political litmus test in the 2020 presidential race. And President Donald Trump brought his plan to Florida this week.
As long as I'm president, no one will lay a hand on your Medicare benefits, and that's what we're here to do today.
The president came to the Villages in Central Florida, a collection of communities for residents 55 years old and older. Now, while some Democrats vying for the White House are pushing versions of Medicare for All health care plans for all Americans, the president wants to expand the private insurance version of Medicare called Medicare Advantage plans. It was the president's first trip to Florida since the House of Representatives opened an impeachment inquiry. And while he went off script occasionally criticizing that effort in the Villages, the effect of the executive order that he signed while there was the latest in a series of health care directives ahead of the 2020 race. So, do you utilize a Medicare health plan, maybe a Medicare Advantage plan? Share your experiences with us here on the Florida Roundup. Are you counting on Medicare when you turn 65? If you're under 65, what do you think of the Democratic push for a Medicare for All type plan? And after all, how important is health insurance to your vote for president? Our statewide phone number, 305-995-1800. 305-995-1800. Or you can join us on social media. Our handle on Twitter is at Florida Roundup. Talia Blake joins us first, a reporter from our sister station WMFE in Orlando. She was at the presidential event in the Villages on Thursday. Talia, thanks for joining us. Set the scene for us. What was that like?
Yeah, so I arrived a few hours before the president was about to start talking, about 10:30 in the morning, and there was already a lot of people in the square. A band was playing live music. Also, the Villages Democratic Club was in one corner already protesting. So people were out there bright and early, ready to see the president.
And it was a fairly small event. This was not a campaign event, after all. This was a White House, a presidential event, correct?
That's correct. And it was invite only, but I was told that there weren't enough people inside. So some people got lucky in the crowd and were able to get inside to watch the president talk.
And the general reception in the hall as well as outside the hall for the president, what was that like?
I mean, a lot of people before we talked, a lot of people were kind of giving concerns about Medicare, and on both sides, they wanted the president to clear up some details around the impeachment inquiry. I heard from protesters and supporters that they wanted that to be addressed so we could move on as a nation. But other than that, people wanted to hear how he planned to strengthen Medicare. We talked to one woman, Jan Schweitzer, who said that in addition to the premiums that she's been paying every month, her husband's on a very expensive medication. And when he's in the donut hole, it costs over $700 just for one prescription. So she really wanted to hear what he was going to do with Medicare.
Prescription drug coverage for Medicare has been a key place for the president. He's talked about those medicine prices. And of course, Governor Ron DeSantis and the Florida State Legislature have also taken steps to encourage and allow the reimportation of drugs into Florida, although the federal government has to step in to make that possible. Amy Goldstein is with us as well. She covers healthcare policy for The Washington Post. She joins us from that newsroom in Washington, D.C. Amy, what did you hear from the president this week in Florida in regards to his stated purpose of trying to expand these Medicare Advantage private health plans?
Good to be with you, Tom. Well, I think big picture, the way to think about what the president was doing in Florida is that if you ask voters what they care about Congress doing to improve things in this country, or what they care about in advance of the 2020 elections, healthcare ranks very, very high. And if you ask people what parts of the healthcare system they like, what ones they think are going well, Medicare ranks very, very high. So I think what you're seeing now is both political parties, both this big field of Democratic candidates and yesterday the president trying to seize Medicare for their own political advantage, saying, you know, I'm the one or we're the ones who are really going to do right by you in the healthcare system.
Yeah, it was interesting, right? The president came out saying, as long as I'm president, no one will lay a hand on your Medicare benefits. Just a few years ago, under Paul Ryan as Speaker of the House, Medicare and Social Security benefits were looked at by the Republican Party as places to save federal government spending.
That's right. I was really struck by the president's line yesterday towards the end of his speech. With every ounce of strength and every bit of soul, we are going to protect Medicare for you. I mean, that really summed up what he was in Florida to talk about.
Yeah. And is he acknowledging some kind of pressure that's on Medicare spending from Congress? Does that exist?
Well, that's kind of the irony of right. where both political parties are at the moment. Some years ago, I've covered healthcare off and on for a very long time, and it used to be that there were presidential commissions that were looking at the future of Medicare, because the concern is with so many people aging in this country and living longer, and with new medical techniques getting developed, new drugs that are effective but cost a lot, that Medicare is going to start running out of money. That concern about the fiscal health of Medicare is not really what either party is talking about. What the president was doing is talking about ways that, as you said, the private sector part of Medicare, which has been known since the early 2000s as Medicare Advantage, could be strengthened. He has some very specific ideas for that he incorporated into this executive order that he signed at the end of his speech. And that really had nothing to do with expanding benefits for more people, which is what the Democrats are talking about, nor did it do with the fiscal health of the program.
Amy Goldstein covers healthcare policy for The Washington Post. She's with us from that newsroom in Washington, D.C. Talia Blake is with us as well, a reporter from our sister station in Orlando, WMFE. She was at the event with President Trump this week in the Villages on Thursday. So how about it? What is your experience with Medicare or Medicare Advantage plans? 305-995-1800. How does Medicare and health coverage under Medicare figure into your financial life here in Florida? How does it figure into your political vote when it comes to the 2020 presidential race? 305-995-1800. Talia, let me ask you, was there a sense of satisfaction or dissatisfaction by the folks in the audience at the Villages when it comes to Medicare? As Amy pointed out, Medicare generally has some pretty high satisfactory marks among people, which is kind of driving this political conversation that we're having around it.
Yeah, I would say the overall feeling was positive. A lot of people said that. Actually, I talked to one man who had recently moved from Rhode Island to the Villages, and he said that his Medicare, he's been paying less since Trump has been in presidency, and he's excited about that. He just wants to know what's going to be happening as we move forward.
And so moving forward, Amy, that there was one thing that the president did do was to sign this executive order with multiple pieces that aim to expand Medicare Advantage, the private insurance piece of Medicare. But before we get into specifics, can the president do that with a stroke of a pen, or does Congress have to act?
Well, what the president was doing was basically issuing a directive to the people working for the administration in the Department of Health and Human Services, asking them to study a whole series of things that would slightly change the nature of private sector Medicare, and then develop new federal regulations or federal rules that would embrace those changes. So what he was doing yesterday wasn't changing the program immediately. It was setting some changes in motion. Yep. And let me just say, so that people understand, that the notion of people being in private health plans as a form of Medicare has been around for a few decades, and it's been growing increasingly popular. Now about one-third of the people on Medicare, or about 22 million people, are in either HMOs or preferred provider organizations, some kind of managed care plan. That's where they're getting their Medicare coverage from.
Yeah. As you catch your breath there, Amy, let me ask you, one of the things that struck me about what the president did in the executive order was looking at the fee-for-service, traditional Medicare, right? So every doctor's visit, every lab test comes with a price, to more closely match prices paid by services under the managed Medicare Advantage plans, which of course are generally more kind of fee for care or negotiated rates. What kind of effect could that have on prices?
Well, it depends. I mean, the whole question of what should health plans be paid in within Medicare has been a political debate for many years. And Democrats tend to think that, well, managed care is an efficient way of providing care. It controls what services people are getting to a greater degree, and therefore it's a cost-saving way of providing Medicare. On the other hand, Republicans tend to think that the private sector is just a better way of delivering health care. Mm-hmm. Forces are good to bring into the healthcare system. So it's sort of gone back and forth what these health plans are paid depending on who's running Congress and who's in the White House. For your specific question, what the executive order does, and it does a whole bunch of things, but one of them is to kind of level out the playing field when people are making their first decisions to enroll in Medicare in the first place, when they turn 65 or otherwise become eligible for Medicare, so that there's not kind of a steering into either the traditional version of the program or this private sector version of the program. Whether that will make a difference is hard to say. As younger people have been turning 65 compared to the people who were turning 65 a few generations ago when there wasn't much thing called managed care, there's already been every year an increase in proportion of new Medicare patients who are joining Medicare Advantage. So whether this executive order will ratchet up what's already an increasing scale remains to be seen.
And move them into this quasi-private insurance market where private insurance companies are managing the Medicare spending on behalf of the federal government. We've opened up the phones here, 305-995-1800. Medicare patient, are you a Medicare Advantage subscriber? Tell us about those experiences. We'll start with Miami Beach in South Florida. Paul on line 10. Go ahead, Paul. You're on the radio.
Well, thank you very much. Just by way of introduction, I've been involved in the field of law and aging for the last 45 years nationally. I wish people would just look at the president's budget proposal to start out. His proposal cuts $880 billion over the next 10 years out of Medicare. It cuts Medicaid, of course, but it cuts Medicare providers by $136 billion. It cuts hospital and patient care by 132. The reason...
So, Paul, let me just step in and ask Amy Goldstein, that covers healthcare policy at the Washington Post. Have you seen those numbers as well, Amy?
Yeah, I don't know the specific numbers off the top of my head, but what is true is that there's been an effort, including in the big healthcare law, the Affordable Care Act, that was passed by a Democratic Congress in 2010, to use some of the spending that had been going into paying people for taking care of Medicare patients, take some of that money and use it instead to help get more people in this country insured. So whether what the president's budget is doing is ratcheting that up or not, I just don't know at this moment. But it's been a pattern because there's been a lot of debate about whether doctors are getting paid too much.
Let me say that the fact is that the Affordable Care Act increased funding and the extension of the Medicare trust fund by 10 years because it took money from the Medicare Advantage plan, if you're aware of that. And so I think, and the other thing they want to do is raise the age from 65 to 67, and they want to give people coupons, which won't keep pace with inflation.
The voucher, the voucher question. I got you, Paul.
Right.
Yeah, Amy, that was a proposal or an idea that was floated back during the Obama administration by the Republican Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, at the time, was to kind of cap. An effort to cap Medicare spending growth was to provide Medicare recipients with a fixed amount of money each year to spend on their health care.
That's right. And that was sort of parallel, not to get too far away from what we're talking about at the moment, but that was parallel to an effort in the Medicaid program by Republicans as they were debating whether to repeal the ACA to provide capped funding to states for their Medicaid program. So this idea of whether there should be vouchers or caps has kind of flitted through the healthcare system in the ideological debates over the past years.
And Talia Blake, as you reported on some of the conversations you were having with the Trump supporters in the Villages on Thursday while the president was there, really focused on prescription drugs as opposed to doctor's visits or hospital visits, correct?
Yeah, they were more talking about how much it's going to cost them every time they have to go pick up that prescription. Some people were talking about what they would pay at the doctors, but they were really more on the prescription drugs, especially with this whole Canadian drug importation thing going on in Florida.
Yeah, the effort to be able to do that, which the state government has approved for the state government and for the folks that it covers, but it still needs the federal okay for that to actually happen. In Pompano Beach in South Florida, Rigoberto is on line four. Go ahead. You are on the radio.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. Yes, I'm a millennial voter, and for me, one of the main concerns is healthcare costs. Unfortunately, I've had an experience where I was between jobs, uncovered, had a car accident, and had a 16-hour hospital stay that was $30,000. So for me, I am looking to support a candidate that will either expand Medicare for all, or some sort of single-payer system. I do believe that healthcare is a right for everyone. And, you know, I do feel that it is an important issue, if not the number one issue for me in the upcoming race.
Rigoberto, thank you for sharing your thoughts and your feelings there. Talia Blake, in the Villages, in the president's remarks, he was kind of offering this counterpoint of the Democratic position of Medicare for all expansion as ruinous to the current Medicare system, and trying to provide a kind of political balance or an economic balance that what he is proposing would in fact shore up the Medicare system or provide more options.
Yeah, that's right. And I wasn't hearing a lot from supporters on how they felt about the Medicare for all. I did talk to one protester, though, they were blowing whistles the whole time the president was talking, trying to distract people from listening to him. And he said that he felt that Medicare as it is just going to destroy us all. And he was a big actual Bernie Sanders supporter that was out there.
Yeah. Let's squeeze in one more quick call before we have to break. Dan on line three in Merritt Island. Go ahead, Dan. You're on the radio.
Hi. I'm a physician, and I just want to make it clear that one of the reasons probably the only reason that Medicare Advantage can save money is because they are private HMOs and they limit the care you can get. You know, as a provider, it's very difficult for me to ever get on the list or provide care to people on Medicare Advantage plans because they really don't want more providers. It would just increase the amount of care that people have access to. And unfortunately, this is a real incentive to them. The advantage of traditional Medicare is that you can see anyone and you can go to any facility.
Yeah. Dan, let me ask you, as a physician, do you accept Medicare in your practice?
Yes, but only the traditional Medicare. It's just not really been feasible to to make arrangements with all the HMOs.
So you do not accept Medicare Advantage in your practice?
No.
You do not.
I actually call it Medicare Disadvantage.
Any idea what the price difference would be paid to you if you were?
It's not a matter of the price difference, although it's a bit lower. The big question is the availability difference.
Gotcha.
Medicare Advantage plans want to be able to limit how many providers they have so that it will be a little bit harder for the patients to get in.
Sure.
It will take them longer.
Dan, we got to run here. Sorry about that.
Okay.
It's less time than a doctor can even spend with a patient sometimes with the phone calls here on the Florida Roundup. Dan from Merritt Island. Amy, we got to let you go as well, but thanks so much for sharing your reporting with us. Amy Goldstein, healthcare policy reporter with The Washington Post. Talia Blake is a reporter at her sister station, WMFE, in Orlando. Thanks to both of you on the Florida Roundup. More still to come. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks again for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. My co-host in Jacksonville, Melissa Ross, is out today.
Florida football is about being the absolute best that you can be. Being a champion's not a sometimes thing. It's a way of life.
Have our best practice of the week.
You're the best you can be today. You can find a way to be a little bit better tomorrow.
This week, HBO premiered a new four-part documentary called 24/7 College Football, and the first school featured, the University of Florida.
On the premiere of 24/7 College Football, a trip to the swamp for an inside look at the Florida Gators.
There's such high expectations, and with that comes a lot of pressure.
And the pressure on schools to allow their student-athletes to make money is increasing. On Monday this week, California became the first state allowing college athletes to sign endorsement deals. The state law bans the National Collegiate Athletic Association, the NC2A, and universities from not allowing those players to play. The new rules would allow college athletes in California to sign endorsement deals beginning in 2023. NC2A rules currently prohibit college athletes, amateurs technically, from profiting from their play. Now, Florida, obviously, college athletics is big business here. According to the Department of Education data, UF Athletics generates $157 million in revenue. Florida State's total sports revenue is $177 million. It's $60 million at UCF, $94 million at the private University of Miami. So this is where our conversation is today. Do you support college athletes signing endorsement deals? Does it change how you would be a fan of college sports? Or are you planning on having a child, a neighbor, a loved one play college sports? What do you think about moving from an amateur status to the possibility of having a college athlete sign an endorsement deal and get paid for it? 305-995-1800 is our phone number, 305-995-1800, or on Twitter at Florida Roundup. Now, Florida lawmakers may vote on a proposal that would follow California's lead and allow college athletes at private and public universities to sign product endorsement deals. One proposal is coming from the Democratic leader of the Florida House of Representatives, Keone McGee. He joins us here live in our Miami studios. Leader McGee, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Nice to see you.
Hey, thank you very much, Tom, for having me. How are you?
I'm well. Why propose this? Why propose allowing Florida collegiate athletes to sign endorsement deals?
Why not? The response is simple. We want fairness. And that's essentially what we're pushing for, is fairness.
What would the legislation allow, and when would it allow it if it passes the legislature and gets the governor's signature?
Well, thank you. So it essentially says this. It would allow for a college athlete to have an opportunity to use his or her name, image, or likeness when dealing with third-party vendors. It doesn't do anything to effectuate change as it relates to the actual agreement that the athlete has with the college.
In other words, a scholarship.
Yeah, with the scholarship. This is totally different from that. We're essentially looking to remove the restrictions that the NCAA has placed on these athletes.
Now, the NC2A has told or threatened California that those athletes at the schools that may allow this endorsement to happen in 2023 in California may not be able to play in sanctioned activities.
Right. And look, and sometimes we have to look at it through the lenses of the NCAA. They're operating under a antiquated system, and this is a teachable moment for them. It's new. So, of course, they're going to feel pressure. They're going to react in a certain way. But I believe at the end of the day, the NCAA will see the writing on the wall that not only is California pushing for this, but now you have Florida and you have Maryland and you have other states, South Carolina, and now you have federal legislation that's possibly being pursued to ensure that this happens.
Yeah, we have heard some rumors about federal congressional representatives thinking about doing something along these lines as well. California, obviously, a big public university state, major college athletics there. Florida, much the same. The numbers I gave you, $150 million a year at UF, $177 million in revenue at FSU. Those two states alone, is that enough to change the tide for the NC2A?
With or without the two states, I can tell you this, the tide has already turned. At the end of the day, the NCAA, I believe, is not going to put itself in a position where it now has to go on a collision course with legislators across this country the legislators who want to protect and give these student athletes an opportunity to remove the restrictions from their name.
305-995-1800, talking about the effort in California that is now state law that allows California collegiate athletes to sign endorsement deals beginning in 2023, and the effort that will be underway in Tallahassee with the new legislative session in January of 2020 to allow much the same here in Florida. 305-995-1800 or at Florida Roundup. Does this change how you think about your alma mater or your college fandom here as we're smack dab in the middle of college football season? On the phone with us is Miami Herald sports reporter Dave Wilson, who covers the University of Miami and South Florida high school teams. Dave, if something like this in Florida would come into play, how does it change collegiate athletes?
Well, obviously, it just changes from the, you know, the schools are kind of going to have to figure out how, you know, it changes. You know, it'll change recruiting, obviously, to an extent. There are questions. You know, it's obviously, you know, I think the kind of counter argument you'll hear people pose is, you know, what's going to stop a booster at a big school from offering, you know, kind of a $1 million deal for a guy to be in an ad at a car dealership? You know, the NCAA will be the NCAA's argument in some cases.
Is it a valid argument, do you think?
It is, but if, like anything, it's, the argument is, you know, how will the NCAA handle it? The NCAA has to figure that out the same way they've figured out problems for years, the way they've, you know, they've kind of tried to avoid this obvious tide that was coming, and you know, they're going to have to figure out how to regulate it. The job's not, you know, it's not, it shouldn't be easy to run the NCAA. It's, you know, they're going to have to adjust the way that anyone else is going to have to adjust to the world changing. It's obviously only going to benefit the athletes who have been, for the most part, you know, taken advantage of, in part because of, you know, their backgrounds. A lot of them come from, especially, you know, here in South Florida, you see a lot of guys from the Liberty City neighborhoods, the Overtown neighborhoods, come from, you know, not as wealthy backgrounds. It was kind of some of the blowback Tim Tebow got for his comments was, you know, he can't come from means, and a lot of guys don't. And they've been kind of taken advantage of in this system.
We'll play Tim Tebow's response to all this in a moment, but somebody who fits the description, Dave, that you just gave us in terms of a college athlete is sitting right to my right here in Miami. Dwayne Starks was a Hurricane at the University of Miami. He was also the 10th overall pick for the 1998 NFL draft, signing with the Baltimore Ravens, part of the team that won the Super Bowl 35, a pick six in that game, I think, Dwayne.
Yes, sir.
Nice to have you on the Florida Roundup.
Oh, my pleasure, man.
Do you support college athletes being able to sign endorsement deals, product endorsement deals?
To some extent, yes. You know, there are a lot of different reasons why they should, and there's a lot of reasons why they should not. But the main reason is because they have been, the main reason they should is because it goes back, and I hate to say it, but it goes back to the slave days, man. You know, we, of course, you've gave us a scholarship. You know, scholarship is good. It's great. It gives us an opportunity to be a student, quotation, student athlete.
You're using air quotes there. Yes. Why so?
Because there are a lot of hidden, a lot of hidden reasons for them to keep us eligible.
Them being the athletic department?
Athletics. Yes, yes. So therefore, if I'm a, let's put it this way, if I'm a student first, there's no worry about getting a job. That's not a problem. You don't owe anybody anything, but rather a student loan or whatever you receive. Mm-hmm. If you're a student athlete, because you gave me a full scholarship, does that mean you take away my ability to earn money or my likeliness? Did you just buy my likeliness for a scholarship? You know, if that was the case, then allow me to get student loans, come to school, and try out on this team.
Did you feel that way at UM, at the University of Miami?
I mean, back then, I didn't know any better.
Mm-hmm. But
I just wanted to play football.
But when you look back
when
on
I
your
look back, I look at a lot of the opportunities that I missed out on.
Such as?
Well, taking the right courses to land a high-paying job out of high school, I mean, out of college. Mm-hmm. You have a lot of kids now. I mean, I was fortunate to be the 10th pick overall. But I had a lot of teammates that was not fortunate. My year was only two guys, maybe three guys drafted. Mm-hmm. Myself, Jamie German, and I think Rich Mercier, who might have been the fifth round or something like that. But there were so many other students, athletes, that graduated or did not graduate and had no place to go. So, it wasn't the education, because some of the athletes are pushed through, and I'm not gonna hide that fact. Some of the athletes are pushed through because, one, the academic advisor's job, he has one job, and he's an athletic academic advisor, mm-hmm. not the academic advisor for the entire school. He's not one of those. He's assigned over the athletes because his fiduciary duties is to keep those athletes eligible and in a counseling way.
Did you feel well served by the academic infrastructure that was around you as a student athlete, as the NC2A called you and your colleagues and still calls?
Did you feel supported? Did I feel supported
in the academic arena? As you felt supported, I presume, in the athletic arena.
I felt supported, but there were things that were missing because of those fiduciary duties of others. Mm-hmm. My purpose as a student athlete, first off, I'm an investment to the school.
Yeah.
The better I play, the better the school does. The better the school does, the more money they generate through television, through shoe deals, all of those things. So therefore, no, I didn't take advantage of those things. That was not a gift to me.
Dwayne Starks is with us, a former University of Miami Hurricane and a Super Bowl winner with the Baltimore Ravens. We're also with the House Democratic leader of the Florida House of Representatives, Keone McGee, and Dave Wilson, sports reporter for the Miami Herald, is with us talking about the potential effort for allowing endorsement deals for student athletes in Florida and elsewhere. Lots of phone calls here. Let's take a look at Wes on line two in Gainesville, right in the heart of the University of Florida. Go ahead, Wes. You're on the radio.
This is a subject near and dear to my heart. In fact, Dwayne may know the kid I'm talking about.
One more time, Wes. We missed the first part there. Right. Go ahead.
I said, Dwayne may know the kid I'm talking about. I coached kids football for 10 years in Miami. Mm-hmm. And these kids, all they want to do is go to college and hopefully make the pros.
Exactly.
Dwayne probably knows the one kid. I coached one kid that made the pros. His name is John Swain. Went to the University of Miami, quarterback, okay. Played for Minnesota for 7 years. And like I say, these kids, all right, let's just say they got 90 players on the team. Let's say they're getting $50,000 a year for a scholarship. That's only $4.5 million. You're talking, and these these schools are making bank off these guys.
Yeah.
Let these guys make some money. It's not professionalism to be able to sell yourself, your visage, or your words to make a couple dollars. They should be able to endorse what they want. I've always believed that.
All right, Wes, we got it. Thanks for joining us. Leader McGee, I'm curious. We had another call, Ashley in Jacksonville, ask about Olympic eligibility. Would your legislation that you're proposing, allowing these college athletes to collect endorsement deals as college athletes, would that affect Olympic eligibility?
I don't believe it will. As a matter of fact, and let me address the question, the statement that we just heard from your last caller also. You know what he just mentioned? Free market. Mm-hmm. That's what this is all about. Mm-hmm. This is about the NCAA removing the restrictions so that these student athletes can participate in the free market. Think about it, Tom. The student athlete is sitting inside of a classroom. He or she has a scholarship, but the student who sits in front of him also has an engineering scholarship. Mm-hmm. Now, the engineering student can go out and sell advertisements, can go out and allow folk to use his or her name freely. So essentially what Rule 12.5.2.1 of the NCAA code book does, essentially sets up an unequal system inside of a classroom, what should be a laboratory for learning.
Dave Wilson with the Miami Herald. Student athletes are looking at this. Certainly football players, basketball players, those that are in the sports that are generating the big revenues for the schools are very well aware of this limitation. How do they go about living with it? And some of them kind of perhaps look for creative ways to bump up against it.
Yeah, well, one of the guys I immediately thought of when, you know, this kind of, when all these bills started going through state houses, was Chad Thomas, who played for Miami a couple of years ago now with the Cleveland Browns.
He's from Booker T. Washington High School right here in Miami, and he's a music producer also. Mm-hmm. And he, I think going into his senior year, if I have this year correctly, he produced a song for Rick Ross. It was the lead track on one of his albums.
I know that kid.
And, yeah, and he didn't end up missing any games, but he did have to kind of go through a whole compliance department at Miami, make sure, you know, he had to give all of his pay stubs to prove that there was nothing, you know, no impermissible benefits, as they're often called, going his way. And on his Twitter account, you know, he had to always kind of use his production name, Major Nine.
Yeah.
On his Twitter account, he had to be sure to keep everything kind of separate. He had his football persona and his music producer persona. And, you know, because he couldn't sell his own music, because people would say he's using his college likeness to sell his music, even though he obviously has this talent that has nothing to do with his college football playing.
Let me remind folks here that you are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio, talking about the possibility of NC2A student-athletes in Florida perhaps collecting endorsement deals. California passed a law, signed an act into law this week allowing that to happen for California student-athletes at universities in 2023. On line 10, Neil is with us on the radio. Go ahead, Neil.
How you doing?
Good.
My point is simply let them sign the deals and all that, but they forfeit their scholarships. I mean, because there's no reason for them to double dip.
So double dip. Dwayne, let me put that to you here. You kind of are grimacing at that idea.
What exactly is double dipping? If you've earned a scholarship and you've done everything that you've done through high school to become a star athlete, now who's to say that student is going to earn enough money to forfeit a 60, 100, maybe, you know, whatever amount that would cover his scholarship? Like, I'm kind of puzzled at why you say double dipping.
Hold on one second. Neil and Dwayne, we're coming up against a clock as well. So let me pause both of you. Go ahead. And then, Neil, just hold on the line. We're going to take a quick break, but I'll have you come back, Neil.
Out of the top 25 schools, each school basically generates a minimum of $400,000 and a maximum about $2 million for one individual athlete.
That cuts across different sports,
football and basketball mainly.
Yeah, right. The two big revenue generators, yes, certainly, because of the endorsement deals and the television contracts.
So double dipping? Who's dipping?
Well, we'll talk about that with Neil, a caller here coming up. We're talking about the NC2A student athletes. Dwayne Starks is with us, former University of Miami Hurricane, Super Bowl champion as well. Keanu McGee, the leader of the House Democrats in Florida, still with us. Stick with us. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks again for listening this week. My co-host Melissa Ross is off. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami, talking about an effort that would allow student athletes in Florida, while attending a university or college, to be able to sign lucrative endorsement deals with products. California passed a law, signed into law this week, that allows California student athletes to do that in 2023. There's an effort where Florida lawmakers may consider a similar law in the upcoming legislative session. Keone McGee is a Democrat from Miami-Dade County. He is the leader of the House Democrats in the state of Florida, in the House of Representatives. We've also got Dave Wilson, who's a sports reporter with us from the Miami Herald, and a former University of Miami Hurricane and former Baltimore Raven and Super Bowl 35 champion Dwayne Starks is along with us. We were just discussing with Neil in Hudson, Florida, Neil's criticism, Dwayne, that allowing student athletes to sign endorsement deals, Neil, you called that double dipping, that they ought to give back their scholarship. Why do you feel that way, Neil?
Well, first of all, they're being given money to get their education. They're playing football to pay back that scholarship.
So do you feel the same way about a star math academic student that's given a scholarship in math, or an engineer student?
Well, gee, do they have the opportunity to go out and get endorsements?
Good question. Keone McGee, stand by, Neil.
Listen, they do. And let's be absolutely clear, in the age of YouTube, Twitter, that engineer student can go on YouTube or Twitter and highlight his or her expertise in that area as far as tutoring other kids and things of that nature.
But there's also a technology transfer involved in universities, which is when something comes out of the research lab that students have been working on that has a commercial application. Oftentimes, Leader McGee, the university will hold that technology transfer. Is there an analogous comparison here?
The comparison that we're talking about is simple. If it's going to be okay for one recipient of a scholarship to do it, then the other one should actually have that same opportunity. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about removing the restrictions that has now been printed in the code book by the NCAA that now trumps the scholarship contract that the student made with the university.
Neil, we appreciate the question there, the thought-provoking position. Dave Wilson with the Miami Herald. I also wanted to ask about, from your perspective, recruiting. Florida is a source of student-athlete labor for college athletics across the country in a number of different sports. Dave Wilson, how would something like this in California, in Florida, how would something like this change perhaps that market?
Yeah, as I was touching on a little bit earlier, you know, the kind of the doomsday scenario that the opponents of these bills have proposed is that it's going to, you know, even further the divide between the, the haves in college sports, the Alabamas, the Clemsons, and, you know, the have-nots, maybe the smaller, you know, the Dukes or the Wakes or, you know, the Boston Colleges, schools that are not traditional powerhouses. Because, you know, obviously people are more recognizable when they're on Alabama or when they're on Clemson. You know, the counter argument to that argument is, well, there already is a huge gap. So I think, you know, obviously it would affect, you know, some of the recruiting pitch. You know, people are already, when they're recruiting players, part of their pitch is, you're going to come to Alabama, you're going to be on ESPN every night, you're going to be a star when you leave college. You're going to, you know, everyone's going to know you. You're going to have endorsement deals once you get to the pros. That pitch is just going to kind of quicken. It's going to be, you know, you're going to come here, you're going to be recognizable, and you're going to be able to make money.
Yeah, yeah. It would give Florida schools a leg up if Alabama or South Carolina or Texas didn't have the same kind of ability for their student athletes to have endorsements.
That's going to be where the NCAA, that's why they have to. If these start passing, they're going to have to change their rules because, well, first of all, if you're going to ban half of the country, you're not going to have a very compelling NCAA. But also, you know, you want different, everyone has to be kind of on a relatively level playing field.
Yeah.
You know, the playing field's never going to be totally level because the athletic departments vary, and they're spending so much. And
let me get to some more listener reaction here. Allie on Twitter sent us this note. I went to undergrad for fine art with an academic scholarship. It would have been absurd for my college to prevent me from making money from the sale of my artwork.
Exactly.
How is this any different?
I got paid writing for the student paper.
So did I. $75 a column. $75 for a few hundred words every week is what I got.
You know, you pack some noodles and Kool-Aid. You could have purchased with that.
I got that to stretch quite a ways back in the 1990s. Yeah. Carlson in Plantation in Broward County on line 4. Carlson, go ahead. You're on the radio.
Yeah, how you doing? Hey, this topic is really hot. It goes back to when I was playing collegiately at Carolina in the 70s. We had no money. We got about $20 for a missed meal, $20 if we were traveling away from school, 2 tickets to a game. I'm envious of the guys today that are making the money that they're making, but that was the times. And I wish that, you know, when I was in school, we could have had access to those big monies. My coach was Frank McGuire. He was a hardliner. I saw a lot of fellows that ended up coming to the school to visit. And, you know, you have the, you know, the face-to-face conversation with fellows, and they were saying, hey, are you guys getting this? Are you guys getting this? And Coach McGuire was one where that wasn't there. And we saw a lot of fellas end up going to North Carolina, Notre Dame, and other schools where cars were available, clothes were available, things of that sort. And did we win a lot of games? Not all the time. But I got my education, and my advisors, my academic advisors, were there throughout the entire time frame. And I saw a lot of talented guys come in that, you know, they fell to the wayside. Hmm. They have no one else to blame but themselves. You have an opportunity at getting a great education at a great organization. And in the end, you have to make your own way. But I think the amateur status is the amateur status. And if you have...
Would this change, Carlson, in your mind, would this change the amateur status of a college athlete if they sign an endorsement deal as an undergraduate athlete with a shoe company, for instance?
Well, there's a way to handle that. You know, put those monies away in a trust and not make it available to you until afterwards.
Yeah, Carlson, good point there. Let me remind folks that you are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Leader McGee, how would this, or would your proposal allowing student athletes to sign endorsement deals with third parties at Florida colleges and universities, would that affect university funding from the state legislature at all?
No. Remember, this piece of legislation specifically deals with third-party vendors. What's happening between the college and the student, that is a legitimate contract that this bill does not affect.
Could it affect, however, the revenue coming in from university endorsement deals?
Well, anything can happen. You're always going to have possibilities and probabilities, but we're dealing with probabilities here because the doomsday scenario will always give us, well, is it possible? Can it happen? Of course, anything can happen. But what I'm saying as it relates to this scenario and this particular bill, no, we don't see an added advantage coming in between the contract between the student and the actual school. Mm-hmm. What we see is an opportunity for the restriction to be removed that would allow for the student's name to be used. And Tom, let's be absolutely clear. This is not simply about advertisement. This is, the student simply wants to be able to use his or her name. The way the rule reads, it prevents that student from using his or her name. The kid from the University of Central Florida,
right.
He had a YouTube page
right,
up.
That's right, yeah.
And we recall what happened with that scenario. So it wasn't about him, it wasn't about the school getting the money. Mm-hmm. It was about controlling and restricting this man's ability to
own
his name.
Is that even ethical? On what happened with him.
Yeah.
I mean, Central Florida kid had a YouTube channel. He lost his scholarship.
Right. He was generating revenue based upon advertisements for the YouTube ad and the NC2A rule.
How was that even?
We'll say that as a college student athlete, you've temporarily given up the right to profit off your likeness.
Right. And what does that go back to?
Well, I want to ask you, slavery is what you mentioned earlier.
I mean, the whole thing is to control where you eat, where you sleep, how much money you can or cannot make. Those things, they were putting in the books.
You experienced this, Wayne. Is there a racial component to this in your estimation?
I'm not going to say it's a racial component because you have all races on a team. Now, I'm not going to take it that far. Mm-hmm. Although a lot of people will, I don't see it that way. I see it that there's a big money grab out there. It's a green issue. It's a big money grab, and because these big Nikes, ESPNs are paying the school all of this money, NCAA, all of this money, and it's not being trickled down to the student himself who's generating those revenues.
What's the role of the fan in this debate, do you think, Dwayne?
What's the what?
The role of the fan. Do they play a role?
I think the fan plays a role because they adore the athlete. So the more they adore the athlete, the more valuable the athlete is.
They're buying the tickets. They're consuming
the
televised broadcasts.
No one would show up to the game if they didn't adore the athlete. If they didn't, because that athlete actually has value, star power. And who's capitalizing off of that? The university. Not an equal amount of what they paid to recoup their scholarship fund that they've given to the athlete, but 3 and 4 times more than what the athlete was bought for. I'll say that, was bought for.
Dwayne Starks has been with us, a former NC2A football player at the University of Miami, NFL player with the Baltimore Ravens, a Super Bowl winner in Super Bowl 35. Thanks for your time and your insight today. Appreciate it. Leader McGee, nice to have you on as well. Keanu McGee, representative from South Dade County here with us. And Dave Wilson, thanks for sharing your reporting as well, a reporter at the Miami Herald with us here on the Florida Roundup. That'll do it for our program. It is produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Denise Royal are their producers. Jason Zabka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming and our Technical Director this hour. WLRN's Director of Radio Operations is Peter Meritz. Engineering help today from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Brady Corum. Our theme music is provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, tweeting, listening. Sorry we couldn't get to all that input. Have a great weekend.